Okay, an actuarial journey into financial planning, or mapping investment opportunities to financial planning needs. I sort of grappled with the title for the paper. Financial planning. The ultimate risk to manage is that of an individual, given the infinite number of unidentifiable variables and events. Humans are inherently unpredictable and thus present actuaries with a real challenge in terms of facilitating their wealth management. But actuaries, as risk specialists, have the skills to advise a map forward and to help review that map as we go on this journey. Actuaries understand both sides of the balance sheet, the needs that must be satisfied, and the investments that can help satisfy those needs. Whilst also being mindful of where things can go wrong, it's important that we be brave enough to make recommendations to encourage clients to move forward positively. So in this paper, I sort of document my experiences so far with financial planning. As I was preparing this, I'll actually read this quote, which is actually from Reddington, rather than that one there, and I think it's just, in the current context, actually quite interesting. Reddington said, "I peer into the future, wondering how it is all going to evolve. It may be that equity dividends may cease to expand, but this is not what we expect because we have large holdings of equities with a substantial reverse yield gap. We can hardly rely on being wrong. We can hardly hope for our own problem to be swallowed up in a national disaster." And I just thought it was interesting to sort of read that from 20 years ago, given all, actually almost 30 years ago, given what's been sort of happening today. It's a slightly different environment then to what we have now, but still relevant. I'll probably talk about four things. One, just a little bit of background, discuss the net worth consumption rate, talk about collective investment variables, and maybe if we have time, we might just talk a little bit about how we actually go about building portfolios in the business that I operate. If I just stand back and just look, like Mark said, I started my career sort of in the late 80s, and I suppose the Campbell Report was sort of the flavour of the month then, and we had all this sort of deregulation and transparency, and I think that's kind of evolved further and further. And I think now if I stand back and have a look, the world is changing as the consumer starts to pay directly for the advice. You know, we're moving, in our world, maybe in a search for equity by generation, changing culturally from the community to the individual, from the mutual to the shareholder, moving towards user pays, transferring more risk to the individual from the institution, and actually empowering the individual to decide how much risk they wish to take. And so this whole environment provides a great opportunity for actuaries to champion the cause of the individual rather than that of the corporate. In terms of wealth management, rather than participating in a pool of assets and so being exposed to the potential abuse of that pool, you can now actually own specific investments in your own portfolio. And I think we're moving into a new era where financial planning can truly map investment opportunities to financial needs. New processes are developing in the market as the individual takes control of their own destiny and demands investment mediums that match their needs. So we are in interesting times as the delivery of solutions through institutional product providers, I think, will gradually diminish and we'll have more customer-centric processes. The consumer will take more control. I think if you just sort of stand back at the moment in your typical super fund, there's quite a bit of distance between the investments and the member. And I think you're going to find that gap is going to gradually reduce. I might just skip through some of these slides. One thing, I mean, flows of money where ownership's not clearly defined are fading, but I don't think that means that our skills are necessarily losing relevance. If anything, it's quite the reverse. Financial planning. Customers arrive with a huge mess. You know, people don't know where they're going, they're lost. There's a whole lot of unanswered questions that sort of come through the door, and people... It's taken me quite a few years to actually work out what financial planning is actually about. It's unreasonable to expect a single statement of advice to provide all the answers. So people turn up and expect they're going to get, you know, one big document, 30 pages, and it's going to have all the answers in it. That's not reasonable. Instead, it's a journey, a series of engagements as clients and planners reflect on their circumstances, document these into a flow of advice, which should be succinct, so we don't get lost in the paperwork, and destroy what should be a refreshing process. the delivery of this advice against a dynamic background is quite challenging. Not only do you have like the global financial crisis and all those issues, but also clients in their own lives have things going on. Arrival of new children, passing on of parents, there's a whole lot of redundancies, the world is very dynamic, and providing advice in that against that background is very, very challenging. Financial planning process, a little bit like the control cycle really. I mean, where you are, where you want to get to, how to get there, strategies to get there, review those strategies, and around we go. It really is just a control cycle. Put the road there because it is like a roadmap. Financial planning brings discipline. In our business, maybe it's actuarial influence, we are very cash flow focused. So we look at the customer's cash flow and we try to get that sorted out first, because you've really got to have that, you've really got to have a good grip on that before you can help people move forward. And that's just not their cash flow, you know, their salary list, their expenses, but also looking at their superannuation, the whole picture. If they're involved in trusts and companies, what are all their cash flows? How can we best take those cash flows forward? In the paper, we actually just sort of have a little excerpt of a model that we sort of use to do that. One thing that's kind of important as a planner is not to judge people. You know, highly skilled technical people, always very good at sort of putting their own views forward, and you've got to really, and I found this quite challenging, you've got to stand back and you've got to listen to people and then try to work with them to find the way forward, and that is really quite challenging. We developed a concept in my business called the net worth consumption rate. Initially, when I started out, I did lots of projections, so that I actually was good at projections, and I used to go and build all these wonderful projection models, and we used to graph them, and that used to absorb an enormous amount of energy. And when I sat back and reflected on that, really, we didn't get anything out of it. It just generated a whole lot of work, but it didn't actually generate any outcome for the client or for me. So I stood back, and really, we developed this concept, the net worth consumption rate. And I think this is where actuaries are quite useful, in that they can take really complicated things and summarise them down into a few simple numbers. This measure, annual expenditure divided by your net worth. So the net worth is really what is available to meet that spend. So if your net worth consumption rate equals the after-tax investment return you expect your net worth to generate, then you have reached self-sufficiency. And so this then leads to what we call the lifestyle sustainability measure, which is your after-tax investment return divided by your net worth consumption rate. So if this value is less than 1, then your lifestyle is not sustainable. Whereas if it's greater than 1, then it is. So people that are sort of in the accumulation stage of life would be accumulating net worth, so their value would be greater than 1. And then as people sort of move towards retirement, then this measure starts to, as people actually retire, then the measure starts to reduce. The long-term sustainability point, which we actually call K here, is really a function of age. So as the individual gets older, then K starts to approach 0. So what that means is the older a person gets, the more they rely on the capital they have accumulated rather than the income they have generated. And that's one reason why I feel really strongly that older people should hold a reasonable amount of cash. You know, we get people coming through the door to us and they might have been a CFO of a big company and they've certainly acquired significant assets, and we'll sit there and say, well, really you should look at putting a third of that into cash, which seems pretty boring and unexciting. In this environment, people have actually appreciated that advice, but in the years up to that, we did get quite a lot of pressure on that point. But I think that's kind of prudent to hold at least a reasonable amount of cash. Just an example. It's always good to sort of learn a concept by just looking at an example. A couple, $1 million in super, $1 million in their home, so $2 million altogether. They could rent their home out for $800 a week, which is roughly $41,600 a year. They spend $8,000 a month, about $96,000 a year. So if you just look at their situation, they spend up roughly $137,600. So we actually factor in the rent, even though they own or occupy their house, because here that circumstance can change. So if you include the whole $2 million, then you get a net worth consumption rate of 6.88%, which is probably not too unreasonable. Sometimes people have this feeling of immortality, that they'll pass the house down to the children, or they're very sort of emotional about the house. And so if they want to drop that out of the equation, then you've only really got $1 million available to fund your spend, and then your net worth consumption rate is 13.76%. You can look at different scenarios. People might say, look, I'm going to downsize in retirement, so therefore I will spend less on rent, so therefore the net worth consumption rate actually reduces. And they might say, I'm going to spend less again, so I'm only going to have one car instead of two, and so it comes down again. But also it's just a useful measure in terms of planning a way forward. So the longer you work, the lower the net worth consumption rate becomes, the more sustainable your lifestyle. In the paper we explore the concept a lot more, but I think I'll just leave that. So that's net worth consumption rate. Developing investment strategies for individuals. Very challenging. The ASIC process requires that you do a volatility test. So customers have to be comfortable with volatility. I don't like volatility tests, but I do them because that's the law. I must give a client a volatility test. My view is you learn about investing by doing and by becoming engaged in the process. But you have volatility on one side, then on the other side you have the client's needs, what risks they can afford to take, what investments may best suit their circumstances. The key issue is a journey that's full of lots of adjustments. One thing that bothers me when I look at the financial planning industry is that financial planning strategies are typically implemented, in the majority of cases, through collective investment vehicles. Now, collective investment vehicles have their place for smaller investors or in situations where the advisor doesn't have the competency for their particular investment, such as international shares, but I don't think they should be used 100% of the time. I really do believe that people should invest directly. So I'm quite critical of strategies which are invested 100% through collective investment vehicles. And in the paper, I've sort of documented quite a few reasons, which I'll just sort of skim through now. The biggest reason in my mind is lack of transparency. Customers cannot see the cash flow coming off their investments, so they can't see the dividends that are coming through to fund their lifestyle. So just to digress a little, some of the presentations that have come through the last few days, people have reported that super fund members have been selling out of volatile assets and buying into cash. Now, people are just scared. And really, because all they can see is their balanced fund, they can't actually see what's happening inside that fund. Whereas clients in our business, they can actually see the dividends coming through. So even though the assets have fallen in value, they can still see the process working. So I think it allows for a much better engagement, and in my view, a much more superior outcome. So that's probably one of my biggest issues with it, that you can't actually understand the investments if they're sort of lost in a unit price somewhere. The fees. The transparency of the fees, what this does, it actually also breaks down the accountability process in terms of justifying the fees for the effort expended. And if you go down further, you actually find in many cases is actually these performance fees. We're human, we naturally get greedy, and you see these fees. I spent a lot of time agonising over this, but if you actually go through quite a few funds, you'll find it's not unusual to have seen fees of 5% or even more in the 06 and the 07 years. And what these fees actually do is they encourage a sort of short-term gain, which then compromises the client's long-term sustainability. They're very asymmetrical incentive mechanisms. So, you know, people get lots of money in the good years, and then in the bad years, you might even find the fund manager actually capitulates or most of the people have left. So I'm really very much against performance fees. The investments, sometimes it's not actually clear what the fund manager is actually investing in, and you might actually find that the investments can actually be significantly more riskier than what you'd realised, particularly if you look at, like, there's plenty of examples, but if you take, like, property trusts, for example, you might find there's significantly more hedging risks involved in the trust than what's actually been disclosed historically. Cost versus benefit. You might find you're actually paying active management fees to get really indexed performance. And this can be even more so the case if you have these sort of fund of funds where they then sort of, you know, spread the money across a whole lot of fund managers and so everything sort of averages out. And I think you can finish up with an index sort of outcome. So it might have been better if the client had just bought STW rather than a whole lot of different funds. Fund managers tend to measure their risk based on a benchmark, and that benchmark may not actually reflect the client's circumstances. So, you know, for a retiree, the risk-neutral benchmark could actually be cash, not the All Ordinaries Index. There's what I call the communal effect, which there was a paper on liquidity. It's probably more like a liquidity issue where the manager has to act for the voters. So if everybody says, I want my money back, the manager has to sell, and he just has to sell at the prices that are in the market at that point in time. And if you've got margin loans in place, which is not unusual, that really just accelerates and amplifies this whole issue. And if you follow the markets and you look at, say, the small cap space, you can see lots of stocks being sold down quite heavily. And sometimes these companies have very little debt or no debt, cash on the balance sheet, good dividends, and they've fallen in value by 80%. And you sort of stand back and you look at that and think, gee, yeah, it's a huge loss. But I don't think, and you've got to be diversified, but I don't think all those companies are going to go under in this global financial crisis. But the investors in those mediums have been forced to sell out of those assets at those prices because that's how the system works. In the long term, they may not have actually got the right price for the asset, but the thing is, it's the assets had to be sold because that's how the system works. Lack of diversification, this really sort of blew me away. A lot of people say, yeah, we'll get into managed funds because they're very diversified, but if you actually go down underneath, it's not unusual to find, even in at the big end of town, that the top 10 stocks are more than half the fund. So sometimes these funds are not as diversified as people think. You know, BHP can be 10, 12% of the fund, Telstra, Commonwealth Bank, ANZ. You can see some quite big positions in some of these funds. In our business, as a rule, we normally don't hold more than 5% exposure to any particular stock, and that we also factor in floating rate notes and the whole sort of exposure. There's other sort of what I'd call second order issues. If you're investing through a managed fund, you can't take advantage of things like buybacks, where you might be able to finesse franking credits. There's a whole sort of personalised things you can do with direct investments you can't sort of do with managed funds. They're less consumer-centric. So like with direct shares, you can actually sort of move them around with off-market transfers. With managed funds, you know, we've been through this in our business, it's hard work. You can't backdate transactions, even if they've had a deceased estate matter and you're trying to sort of wind that up. It just adds another level of frustration to the whole sort of customer experience. Whereas with direct investments, you can actually do things a lot easier. So overall, I'm fairly critical of direct investment. critical of collective investment vehicles. Black box. The client can't really appreciate what's going on inside. The level of client engagement, I don't think, is really healthy. Now, I might skip through some of these slides just in...
You've got 2 or 3 minutes.
When you actually put portfolios together, we could almost debate this slide, you know, where things actually sit on the risk spectrum. So you're sort of putting... And this has been a real issue to sort of grapple with going forward. We might actually come back to that, depending how the discussion goes. I'll leave... what I might do is just jump maybe to the conclusion. We can come back.
Yeah.
I think if I just reflect high level on my journey, the things that I've learnt... One, diversification. No matter how good it looks, it can still go wrong. If you engage a lot of investment people or investment professionals, they're very passionate people and they'll really believe in a stock. You know, say, oh, you should put 10 or 15% in this particular stock. When they see something they really believe in it, I think you need to stand back and diversify because, yeah, you can make mistakes. Things can go wrong. We've unfortunately, you know, bought shares for people that have gone insolvent or gone under. Now, we've bought lots of other shares as well. The thing is, when you invest directly, the mistakes, if you want to call them, they're very transparent. You know, they don't get lost in the wash like they do with a managed fund. The person who never made a mistake never learnt anything, so don't think that every single stock you buy is going to be a winner. Again, I come back to this point, I think the level of client engagement that comes from direct investing ultimately leads to a superior outcome. Holding adequate cash. I wrote a little article about this too in Actuary Australia about a year ago. Gradual execution of planning strategies. It's an iterative process. In my business, if someone turns up with $1 million to invest, we don't invest that in one go. We might take a couple of years to put that money into the market because people don't know where they're going. We don't know where the market's going. You know, you could get a small business operator who sold his business and he's converted all that into cash. We just don't take that and put that straight into the market. You've got to move very slowly. You've got to learn with people, see where they're at. It's a gradual sort of process because their circumstances can change. I think you don't want to do anything that's going to compromise someone's financial future. You've got to have a good reason for doing things. And really, one thing with financial planning, it's not actually about creating wealth, in my view. It's more about maintaining and guiding the creation of wealth that's maybe come from people's careers, from the fruits of their labour. So people shouldn't turn up expecting they're going to win lotto by seeing a financial planner. I don't think that's what it's about. Regular client engagement. be a good listener, keep an awareness of where the investor is travelling in life. You've got to continually challenge the suitability of the assets that you've got within portfolios. You know, like a good example of that, we were doing term deposits that maybe we used to spread them through the year, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, and things keep changing. Then we started doing some longer dated term deposits. You work out a formula and you stay with it, and you find you've got to change it, and then that can be quite challenging as well. Limited use of investment collective vehicles. Finally, I think it's important as actuaries not to get distracted with the mathematics, but instead to dig deeper and try to understand what's happening underneath. At this convention here, I've seen some papers where the maths has been really powerful and the intellectual skill really outstanding, and some of the work quite awesome. And in my view, I think if that actuarial intellect could be applied successfully to that actuarial intellect could be applied successfully to direct investing. I think there's some real skills that we have in this area. And on that note, I might hand over to comments.
Thanks, Mark. Anyone got an opening question? Well, if you want to, if you want to ask a question or make a comment, go to the microphone and please identify yourself for the purpose of the tape recording. We've got quite a bit of time for questions and discussion. It's meant to be a workshop format, and I hope it'll be quite interactive. Thanks, Alex.
Alex Borowski here. Just a quick question. What do you think about the future of wrap platforms in putting forward this financial planning process?
I think we're going to see lots of changes with wrap platforms. I think they're here to stay, but they're going to become much, much cheaper. I think the costs are going to fall significantly. We're going to see this sort of evolution of the IMA, I suppose. So at the moment, a lot of these platforms, they're great sources of profit for the provider of the platform, but they don't sort of give a great deal to the consumer. I mean, just reflecting, we had a client come through about 3 weeks ago, and they were on a wrap platform, and they'd lost a fair bit of money. Like all clients have lost, Marcus Danfield lost money, but this particular situation, I think their losses had been exaggerated by the fact that they were in a wrap platform, because what the planner had done, he couldn't put the money into a term deposit, the money you'd put into like cash or stable things. What he'd done, he invested it in mortgage funds. And then what actually happened then is those mortgage funds, you know, fallen a lot in value or they're frozen. Whereas in our business, we actually go and buy term deposits and put it into proper cash. And so I think that's one of the weaknesses of wrap platforms. Even like, I'm not aware of a platform that actually has a term deposit on it. I mean, you can buy cash and things like that, but if you want to actually get a term deposit or something like a bond, you can't actually do that. That'll change. The platforms will get more flexible. I think the costs will come down quite a lot. And I think you'll even see the industry funds sort of start to get into this place as they become a medium to sort of, you know, put direct investments rather than going into managed funds. You'll find you'll have, you know, model portfolios sitting up there on platforms, so people will have their ANZ, their BHP, their CS, or whatever the model is, and they'll actually just buy really like an IMA.
We had a question here.
Raymond Yao. Mark, I was just looking at that NWCR, the net worth consumption rate that you had in the Lifestyle Sustainability Index. And when I saw that, I mean, one of the questions I had, and whether you had considered that in your practice, was that the income that you receive from your investments, so I think it's actually the next one, it's the lifestyle investment, after-tax investment return. You know, part of that return is actually a return for inflation. So should consideration be given to sort of subtracting some sort of amount for the fact that, you know, you want to keep your investment returns after tax after inflation return?
Yeah, that's right. Once you put a measure up, you'll find all sorts of inadequacies with it. I think the main thing to sort of realise is that it's a tool to sort of guide the way forward. So, I mean, like, maybe what you're trying to do with an investment strategy is give people a portfolio of investments where the income is maybe going to grow with inflation. Now, there's no investment out there that really guarantees that, but that's what you're sort of trying to do. mathematically, there's quite a lot of issues with the net worth consumption rate. I mean, you've just pointed out one issue there with inflation, capital gains tax, you know, how you deal with that. There's quite a few things you can as you deal into it. But I think as a measure, it does actually give people a good feel for their solvency, if you like. How solvent are you as an individual? This measure, I think, actually gives you a feel for that. But I agree, yeah, I mean, you can make all sorts of adjustments to it.
Thanks, Mike.
Mike Barker. Just wondering what you think of the role of structured products in financial planning. I've pretty much come the full circle on that. I still think when you actually try and do a plan for somebody, they've often got multiple objectives, and so the classic answer ought to be that build some sort of structured product that meets more than one of those objectives. And I used to try and build things like that in an earlier life. But having had more experience with planners recently, having seen the sort of things that go on, I've come the full circle and think that most structured products are way beyond the ability of the client to understand, and they're really a danger to humanity rather than a solution. But I'd be interested to see what your attitude is.
Yeah, one of my beliefs, first of all, is if you don't understand an investment, then you shouldn't be recommending it. You shouldn't be putting clients' money in it. That's a fundamental rule. Now, you'll find when you get out there, a lot of planners actually don't understand the investments, which is disappointing, but you've got to understand what you're putting in front of clients. The thing with structured products, I believe in this, keeping things simple, which is why, like in our business, we do very basic things. Sometimes people come to see me and they're a bit disappointed. I say, you're an actuary, you don't do derivatives, you don't do options, you don't do all these other exciting CFDs, whatever it is. We do pretty boring stuff. We just buy shares, we buy term deposits. It's black and white, it's vanilla, we understand it, it's simple. So I sort of keep away from structured products because you just don't know what's underneath there. Just, when you peer inside, like when hedge funds sort of took off, you know, we had a close look at them and I just couldn't understand how they worked, so I just didn't do them.
Has anyone like to make a defence of collective investment vehicles, which I thought was fairly controversial criticism there?
Craig McLean. Not so much a defence of them, but I assume most financial planners put their clients into them because it's delegating the share selection to someone else. And I was just wondering, Mark, how do you actually select the shares and what percentage of your time is spent on that? Because I would have thought it was a very time-consuming thing to actually do the share portfolio and not delegate it to a fund manager.
Yeah, that's right. It is quite a time-consuming task. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote this paper, actually. It was initially to sort of get on top of that. I'll just come to that slide there. In my business, I run an investment committee. Mark's a member of that committee. That committee meets formally four times a year. And we sort of look at the market and look at where things are going. And out of that committee, I suppose, we develop what we call like a model portfolio. As we sort of stand back and look at that, and being an actuary doing direct investing, we've actually finished up with fairly highly diversified portfolios because I just do like to spread money around. And sort of standing back, looking at that and thinking, well, maybe we've gone a bit too far with the diversification process, and that's why we're just going to stand back. And that was one of the sort of reasons for putting this paper together. What we do, I sort of try to put up in this table here very simply. We look at things by sectors, first of all, or even by themes. So you might sort of say, look, you know, we think energy or resources is going to be good. What's the best stock in that sector? And we might think it's BHP. And then we actually have this sort of tiering system where we rate stocks. So as people come along, if you've got a very small investor, they might just buy all the tier one stocks. If they just turn up with $10,000, we might just buy four stocks is a bit small, but, well, 10,000 is a bit small. You probably want to have a bit more money than that, but we'd probably buy maybe eight stocks as a minimum, and they might be all tier one stocks. And then as they have more and more money, then we move along the tiers. And even though, you know, someone may turn up with many millions of dollars, you know, 5 or 6 million, I still struggle with having lots of money invested in a single stock because things can still go wrong. So you sort of diversify out as you move along the structure there. But, I mean, the committee meets each quarter. It critiques what we did last quarter. It's a learning process. You've got to sort of keep evolving, and yeah, obviously markets are very dynamic. We did do a little bit in the small cap space, which has hurt our portfolios a little bit just in recent times. But I think, you know, I think when markets recover, they're the stocks that might move up the quickest. But at a high level, while that people have suffered a little bit there, they've made up for the fact that we did hold high levels of cash because we were nervous on the market. So it sort of balanced out. But maybe that gives you a rough idea how we do the direct investing. Client always signs off on the transactions. So, you know, we'll go through and sort of talk about the shares. I mean, people have those shares there. Most people in the street would have a feeling for BHP, Woolworths, CSL, Westpac Bank. Most people would know those sort of stocks. But as you sort of move further down the tree, like a stock like Fleetwood or DWS or something like that, people wouldn't know that stock. You'd have to spend a little bit of time just explaining that there.
I might just make a comment on my perspective on collective investment vehicles with financial planners is that I think actuaries and asset allocators sometimes underestimate the amount of how much conviction there is in portfolios, and often there's fairly low conviction in a lot of institutional portfolios and a lot of sort of shadow index tracking, and yet fairly high fees charged for what's effectively a tilted or quasi-index product. That's not the case all the time. There are some high conviction managers, but even if you pick multiple high conviction managers, you're effectively almost getting an index type return and yet paying quite high fees for it, whereas Mark said you may just be better off buying STW. The other point I really agree with Mark is in connection with, say, BHP might be 12% of the index. That doesn't necessarily mean Joe Bloggs from Epping should have 12% of his life savings invested in BHP, albeit quite a sound company, and it may be a more equi-balanced weighting. And, you know, the law of large numbers, or whatever it is, means perhaps it's very hard for BHP to quadruple its size over the next 5 years, where a $200 million company may be able to do that.
Yeah, that's right. I thought maybe I'd put this slide up. This has been another sort of area where there's been a lot of listed income securities. They've really sort of come off a lot in sort of recent times. We had a little bit of these spread across in portfolios, and I think it was just as well as an actuary because we didn't put a third of portfolios into these. Someone with $1 million might have finished up with 100,000 in listed income securities and the other 200,000 in term deposits. But we still did invest in them, and they, you know, if you look at like the Westpac one there, for example, it's down sort of 24%, and it's been down a lot more than that. These securities with the credit crunch, you know, they used, prior to the credit crunch, you know, they'd pretty much just sit at face value. You know, they'd be $100, they'd go up, pay a dividend, go back down again, they'd just sort of move along like that. All of a sudden, when the credit crunch struck, like, for example, NABHA, they just sort of really just came right down. And like with these, you can still see the dividends coming through. And this is why I think, you know, going directly with these investments is actually quite helpful, because people can still see the money coming into their account from the dividends. Whereas if you had these things in a managed fund, all they'd see is the unit price dropping through the floor, and that would just create a lot of anxiety within clients. Whereas if they've got the things in directly, like I don't think Westpac is going to go under or Commonwealth Bank, but at the moment these securities are quite low. Now, it may even represent a buying opportunity, who knows, but at least if you own it directly, you can still see the income coming off the investment. So it's doing what it was intended to do.
I'd like to ask Mark about actuaries in financial planning. You've taken this unusual step. Can you give sort of any observations on what it's been like for you to go from working for one of the largest insurers in the world to working with fairly small clients in an almost retail environment?
Yeah, when I actually, that's a good question. When I wrote this paper, a few people said they were expecting more of that sort of information to be in the paper rather than this. It's quite a challenge. If you're in a corporate, you know, you do sit on a bit of a cushion. Things are sort of done for you. Whereas when you sort of initially start your own business, you've got to get out there and sort a lot of things out yourself. So initially, you know, Mark Berry was the IT department. He was the HR department. He had to deal with a tax office like this. And the issues you've got to go up against are just overwhelming. And then you've got all that sort of stuff. And then you've got to go and deal with ASIC and, you know, the ATO, and there's all that as well. And then you've got, you know, initially when we first started out, we actually didn't do so much direct investing. We just actually used to use managed funds. But a gentleman who actually helped me get started, a guy called James Allen, he sort of came in for a year and he said to me, well, actually, we're doing this all wrong. I mean, he and I both owned direct shares and yet clients had come through and we were doing managed funds. And he sort of said, we really got to change how we do things. We should be investing for clients in the same way we invest for ourselves. And that was quite a challenge, but I mean, I really took his feedback and we sat down, because if I go into the market and I buy some shares, okay, they go down and I've got to explain to Patricia, okay, whatever, we bought these stocks. Whereas you sit down and try and explain that to a client, it's a little bit different. And so it's that was quite a, a very stressful transition for me, I'd have to say. I mean, I had to sort of, even the transaction form the client signs, I mean, I had a couple of goes at designing that. And actually, clients helped me actually sort of put that process together. And what do I actually do? How do I pick the share? Someone asked that question there. How do we, you actually have to go and define that whole process to the client so they can actually start to become comfortable with how we actually do things. And that was quite a challenge. I mean, people actually ask, so yeah, how do you get clients? How do you grow your business? And I think a lot of it's just really word of mouth. That's the other thing I sort of learned. When I first got going, we did lots of advertising, which made me feel good because I thought I was doing something. But at the end of the day, it really didn't generate. I mean, you just got to sit there and do the hard yards and just work client by client.
Mark, you've proposed that the Institute of Actuaries possibly consider a financial planning course. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, I think actuaries can really contribute a lot in financial planning. And one of the things I found a bit frustrating was that the actuarial qualification, when I initially went to get my own AFSL, wasn't actually recognised. So I had to sort of go through and do the Security Institute exams. And actually, in terms of the regulatory environment, I don't really need my actuarial qualification to sort of do the things that I do. And yet I think it's so useful and really... allows me to provide such a much higher or more superior service than sort of the average financial planner. So that's an area where we probably do need to do more work. I know I've been involved in the financial planning committee, and I'm probably one of the ones where it's hard to contribute to these things as well, because you get busy in your own business, and I'm sort of trying to sort of still get myself off the ground and sort of get bogged down in institute stuff. I don't really have the time, and I think if you talk around, there's quite a few of us out there in the marketplace, but most actuaries in financial planning are like me. They're out there just trying to, you know, get their business going. But I think maybe give it another 5 years when we've sort of developed more mature businesses, I think then we probably could sit down with the institute and actually put together a financial planning course and bring the actuarial qualification into retail financial planning. I think that'd be a good thing. There's also the tax office, and they're another group you've got to deal with as well. If we can have our qualification so it's recognised by the tax office, that would be quite useful as well. They're the two main regulators I deal with, the ATO and ASIC.
We've just got time for one or two more, perhaps one last question or two. Yeah.
Raymond Yao again. I was also interested in seeing those that matrix of shares that you had for the Australian market. I mean, you know, what intrigues me is that the Australian share market is like, what, 2-3% percent of global world market cap. And, you know, what's your philosophy in terms of, you know, having 25-50% of a person's... shares in Australia when you know, there's some stocks which you just can't get.
My view is you can build adequate diversification in an Australian. There's a lot of stocks in the Australian market. There's quite a lot of diversity out there. You've got a whole range of companies in the market, the health stocks, finance stocks, Fleetwood's a stock that I like a lot, the IT businesses. There's a whole range of things out there. The thing with international investing is you've got to go... I suppose with these stocks, I can touch them, I understand them. I actually go out and visit the companies as well. We put some time into that. We attend the investment presentations. I actually sort of understand. The shares are in customers' portfolios. I have a reasonable feel for those. Whereas with international shares, I just don't have that feel. But I think what will happen is the time will come, maybe might be 10 years down the track, when you'll actually be able to buy shares on the New York Stock Exchange from Australia. Now, the thing is having the research and being able to make informed decisions about what shares to buy, but I think the world is shrinking and the time will come when you'll be able to buy international shares directly from Australia.
Okay, and they're opening the doors. We'll have to wrap it up. I'd like to thank Mark for a fantastic presentation. I think he's given a very good synopsis of the paper. As I said, I commend you to read it. If you're interested in this topic, stick around. Mark Barker, I think, is in this room next. Is that right, Mark? You're speaking here. And I've got a bottle of wine for Mark. If you give him a round of applause.